On today's episode of the Productivity Podcast, I'm talking about productivity tips for freelancers with Ryan Wagoner.
Welcome to the Productivity Podcast, the show that will supercharge your productivity fast. Get more done with actionable, easy-to-follow advice, and become a Jedi Master of Productivity. And now, introducing your host, Paul Miners.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Productivity Podcast. It is a pleasure to have you listening today. As always, I appreciate your time and attention because I know how valuable those things are. Is that getting corny yet? Should I stop saying that? Do you have an alternate intro for me? Let me know. I don't know if I should keep saying that. Anyway, on to today's episode. I've got an interview for you today with Ryan Wagoner, who is an expert freelancer who helps other freelancers to be more productive and to be more effective and efficient with how they use their time and serve their clients. Had a great conversation with Ryan, bit of a selfish interview because I have been getting into more and more consulting and kind of freelancing on the side. And even if you're not a freelancer, or if you just, you know, work in a normal office job, this is a really interesting episode because you'll learn about Ryan's processes and the principles of productivity that he follows that will, of course, apply to, I'm sure, many of the things that you're doing. And, you know, if you're not freelancing at the moment, it is a really good option to earn a little bit of extra side income on your on the side of your part-time job. If you've got skills and you know things that people need help with, if you get people asking you questions about, hey, how do you do that? Then that is an opportunity for you to earn a side income, which is very much what I'm focusing on right now. So yeah, had a really interesting conversation with Ryan about qualifying clients, his processes for managing his clients and productivity habits that he follows. So if you want to check out the show notes for this episode, you can find them at paulminers.com/47, which will include the questions and of course the links to the different things that we discuss. As always, enjoy the show, and yeah, without any further ado, let's get into this conversation with Ryan Wagoner. Enjoy. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Productivity Podcast, and today I am joined by Ryan Wagoner from ryanwagoner.com. Hey Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hey Paul, it's great to be here.
So just a quick intro to Ryan. I'm going to let him obviously share his story and tell you a bit about what he does. But Ryan is a freelance expert. He on his website, he is a coach, and he basically helps freelancers, any kind of solo entrepreneurs, people who are working for themselves, to grow their business, to be more productive and more efficient with how they're managing their time as a freelancer, obviously improving systems, and yeah, like getting in new clients and new work. So as someone myself who is starting to do a bit of kind of coaching and consulting in my business, as well as, you know, running the site and doing the blog and things, I'm really keen to talk to you, Ryan, to learn a bit more about this whole world of like freelancing and consulting. So yeah, thanks for coming on the show.
Absolutely. It's one of my favorite topics.
Well, hey, why don't we start with, if you could give us a bit of an introduction to yourself for people who maybe haven't heard of you. Who is Ryan Wagoner? And tell us a bit more about what you do and your story. How did you end up where you are today?
Sure. So I am a consultant myself, and that's where I spend the bulk of my time. I probably spend 80% of my time actively working with clients. And then the other 20% I spend working with other freelancers and solo consultants to help them figure out the best way to grow their business. And so that involves writing and speaking and appearing on podcasts like this. And I have some products that I produce and so forth. And I do some coaching and that kind of thing. This, you know, I'm kind of in the process of shrinking my consulting and growing like this aspect of my business of helping other freelancers. I've been a freelancer for 9 years. I started doing web development, and these days I do mostly mobile app development and kind of product management for companies that are mobile focused. And I basically got into this because I was working in product management in San Francisco. I'd always wanted to work for myself, and I started moonlighting, just doing some freelance web development in the evenings. And after a few weeks, I just felt like I could probably make a go of this. So I quit my job, and that was, I think I was 24 whenever I did that, and I'm about to turn 34. I hope to never have a job again. So the it's been, you know, it's had its ups and downs. The first few years were really rough, but over the last few years, it's grown into something where I feel like I can do this for the next 20 years and really, you know, have this be my career, not just a stepping stone or something to kind of bridge a gap in my resume. So because I've been successful at it, I want to help other freelancers be successful at it too, because I know what it's like to, you know, to be stressed out and to feel like you're not sure how to figure out if this can work for you or what you should do to get good clients and good projects and have it be sustainable.
Yeah, I'm really interested to learn more about that transition you made. So you said you were working as a product manager. Out of interest, what kind of products or what kind of work was that?
So I worked at CNET, which is now CBS Interactive, and I worked on GameSpot.com, which is like their big kind of gaming portal and so forth. So I worked with a technical team that was building a couple of different products, but you know, pretty big audiences. The products that we were building were complicated. My responsibility was to help kind of manage the project, but also to talk to the business side and understand what the business goals are, to talk to the technical team and understand the issues they were running into, and to do translation between the two. But ultimately, to be an advocate for the user throughout all of this, just because that's really, at best, that's a product manager's role, is to be an advocate for the user. So that's what I was doing. But my degree is in business, but I've been programming since I was a kid. So product management was interesting just because it existed at the kind of intersection of the business side and the technical side. And when I started freelancing, I was really just doing the technical side. But one of the things that I think has been really beneficial for me is understanding how the technical work that I'm doing really impacts the business goals. And that, I think, has been a huge boost to my career.
And so, sorry if I missed it. When you first started moonlighting, as you described it, you were programming. What kind of work were you initially doing when you first took that step into like the freelance role on your own?
Yeah. So the I literally started because I saw a freelance job post on Craigslist, and I was like, that sounds like something I could do. And it was for a guy who ran like a small design shop in Los Angeles. I was in San Francisco at the time. And he had built like this e-commerce thing, like a checkout page for a client of his, and it was broken and they needed somebody to go in and like figure out what was going on and fix it and then make some changes and updates and stuff. It was not great work in the sense that like, it was really poorly built and, I was pretty inexperienced and so forth, but it, you know, back then as now, there was good demand for people who have that skill set. And so I was able to kind of jump in and help him out with that. And he had more stuff and I responded to some other stuff and started getting more and more clients. And San Francisco was a good place. So I got some local clients as well. It wasn't anything super complicated. I just started responding to people who were looking for what I could do.
That's really cool, because I'm sort of in this space right now in this transition phase. How long, when were you doing this kind of moonlighting for, kind of doing the full-time job but doing the freelance work on the side? How did that transition look? Like, was it a 6-month or a 12-month shift, or were you able to make the transition fairly quickly? How did you kind of make that jump?
Yeah. In retrospect, it probably should have been a 6 or 12 month shift. It was actually about 2 or 3 weeks. So,
oh, wow.
Like, I literally started working and like I was working like nights and then weekends for a couple of weeks, and I was making, I think I was charging $50 an hour, which now I don't recommend people charge hourly, but I was. And I kind of did this really naive calculation of like, oh, well, if I just did this for 40 hours a week, you know, 50 weeks a year, then that's 2000 hours a year. And so I could make $100,000 charging $50 an hour. And so I quit my job because that was more than I was making at my job. You know, it turns out for a bunch of reasons, that's a really naive and unrealistic calculation to make. And as a result, like the next few years were pretty difficult in many ways.
So if you're not going to, you said you recommend not charging hourly then, I'm assuming then you would recommend like a per project kind of budget or quote for the work instead.
So ideally, yes. I mean, I think that selling your time is kind of a fundamental misunderstanding of like the best value that you can offer as a freelancer. So no client wants to buy your time. Like nobody cares about the time that you're putting in. Ultimately, clients are trying to buy a set of results. And the closer that you can get to selling them a set of results at a certain price that's valuable to them, that makes sense for them, the better it's going to be for your career in the long run. Now, that doesn't mean that it always makes sense to do like a flat per project fee. You know, it may be something where the project is more open-ended or the scope is really difficult to define for whatever reason. And so if you have to sell your time, if you feel like you have to, I would at least recommend trying to do a daily or a weekly rate. Just because it starts to get away from the, I mean, no one would want to do like a minute rate. Like no one's going to charge like a dollar a minute. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to me to charge per hour either. Like people tend to do work in bigger chunks of time. And so I think a weekly rate at least is good. But I for 80% of the work that I do, 90% of the work that I do, I charge a per project rate. And I found that to be really beneficial in the long run.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I feel like a lot of people, myself included, when they first start out, do kind of default to their hourly rate. So it's really interesting to kind of challenge yourself to think about different models that you can use. I'm interested, just moving on, to learn a bit more about your advice for people listening who maybe they are in a full-time job at the moment and they want to work for themselves. And I think, yeah, a lot of people fall into this category where maybe they don't enjoy their job or they have this passion they'd like to pursue and ultimately just be more accountable to themselves and create like freedom through freelancing and working for themselves. So what kind of advice, and particularly from like a productivity standpoint, if people are looking at getting started with freelancing kind of quote on the side, how can people... Do you recommend like manage that process and kind of be more productive while getting started? Because there's so many things you can do in the beginning. You could set up a website, you can go to reach clients, you can try and market yourself in a number of different ways. Like, what are the best things that people can do in the beginning to kind of take those critical first few steps?
Sure. So there's kind of a bunch of different answers to this. It depends a little bit on your situation, and the type of work that you're trying to do on the side and what your ultimate goals are and so forth. The first thing I would say though is not to worry about like a website or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, I did six figures a year for years without having a website basically. I mean, I had a blog, but it didn't really have anything to do with the work that I was doing for clients. So you don't need business cards. Like I wouldn't worry about like necessarily worry too much about the legal side of everything. Again, depending on your situation, I'm not an attorney and I'm definitely not your attorney. So, the most important thing I think that you should focus on, in the beginning is figuring out who your clients are and what it is that you're going to do for them. Like, so what problem are you solving for them? I think for some people is pretty easy. Like, you know, that comes pretty naturally. In my case, like that came really naturally. But for some people, I think they may have to think a little bit more carefully about what that is. If their motivation is just to kind of work for themselves, but they maybe haven't thought about it kind of beyond that in terms of what that would look like or what they're going to offer to the market. But I would encourage people not to worry too much about kind of like the marketing collateral stuff, like business cards and a website and those kinds of things, because the reality is like the vast majority of people don't need that to get started. Like email is more than sufficient, usually to kind of talk through what you can do for a client and to sell them on an engagement.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I totally agree. Like when you're first getting started, and you just need to have those quick wins, right? You need to get out there and like find a client as quick as you can to kind of validate your ideas as well. I find like you want to be able to prove that the clients you're looking for are the right kind of people and the services you offer kind of fulfill some need that they have. And if you kind of fluff around like with websites and business cards and all this stuff that makes you kind of feel productive, like you're doing important things rather than actually the grunt work of going to find the clients, it can I think ruin your motivation later, because you're like, oh, I've got a website, why aren't people finding me? And then you kind of lose motivation and give up. And I almost think maybe those activities like making a website or creating a business card, people kind of use those as a way to procrastinate from and like shy away from the hard work, which is actually finding clients, right? It's not easy getting those first few clients.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think you nailed it. It's basically a form of procrastination. It feels like you're doing work and making progress. In some very small sense you are, but that's not the most important thing. That's not the most difficult thing. And for most people, I think they're probably putting off like the hard thing, which is to go out and actually sell yourself. I think if you're in a field where you can do this, like the easiest thing by far, is to just look for people who are looking for somebody who does what you do. So if you're a designer, like there's like a billion places online that you can find people who are posting to try and find a designer to design something for them. And same thing for software engineers and for writers and so forth. And that's a fine place to start. You don't necessarily have to go out and start like banging on doors to try and find clients. If there are people out there who are looking for what you do, the easiest thing is just raise your hand and say like, hey, I do that. And that's a fine place to start.
Yeah, actually, if we could dive into that a bit more, do you have any more specifics on how people can find their first few clients? So obviously there are some specific sites like, for example, 99 Designs for designers, and you've got like Fiverr, and you mentioned Craigslist earlier. Do you, and so yeah, there are some specific things for different types of industry and different types of work, but do you have any like really good sites that for, I don't know, like more generic work that people can kind of check out? Like how can people really go out and find those people that have the services that you need?
I mean, it's, you know, we're talking to kind of a, from a general audience perspective. And so it's a little bit tough. I think, I mean, Craigslist is really the bazaar of the internet. So there's like people looking on Craigslist for just about everything you can imagine. And so that's one kind of easy answer of like some place to get started. The, you know, there's sites like Upwork that are pretty, you know, offer a pretty broad array of different types of freelance services and stuff. I'm not a huge fan of those sites, partly because they really encourage you early on to, they push you into a commodity mold. So you are basically like competing with other people from all over the world, many of whom charge a few dollars an hour, basically. And it's not a good way to kind of start off your freelance career in terms of the way that you think about yourself and your value to clients. And the same is true, even worse, I think, for something like Fiverr. So I would encourage you to look for places where you can connect directly with clients, and where there's not this kind of like bidding process that really encourages like the race to the bottom in terms of charge as little as possible. I mean, the premise of something like Upwork, which, you know, I think was a merger of Odesk and Elance, is basically like you post a job and a bunch of people like compete for it so you can pick like the best person up charging the cheapest price. And ultimately that's what everybody's trying to do, but it really turns it into a commodity where like, you know, here are a bunch of people who can do what you're asking, but that's not actually the case. Like you want to be a freelancer, you want to be a consultant who your clients see as like, this person is like, they know exactly what I'm looking for. They really get it. They may not be cheap, but they're going to definitely solve my problem. And it's hard to do that whenever you're kind of lining yourself up with a bunch of other people from all over the world who are presenting, you know, kind of, we're all, any of us could do this. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And I think I'm so glad you made this point because, like, as people listening, you know, your productivity podcast listeners, you guys know that that time is your most valuable asset. And so to be charging by the hour and, excuse me, like, to be racing for the bottom, as you put it, in terms of pricing, is just, it's completely against what, you know, I'm sure people listening to this podcast believe in, which is like being effective and efficient with how they manage their time. And if you're charging like a lowball hourly rate for some really big project or a lot of work and it's not going to be worth your time, then you're doing yourself a disservice. So yeah, really glad you made that point. And just want to challenge people, if you are freelancing or thinking about freelancing, to really like, even in the beginning when it's, yeah, you're getting started, you might have to make a few sacrifices and do a bit, some harder work for maybe a bit less than you would like, but to really challenge yourself to position yourself at a price point where it's going to be worth your time, because time is such a valuable asset, right?
Right. The other thing I would say too is look for places to find clients where you can own that relationship. So that's another issue I have with something like Upwork or Fiverr, which is that you can't really move the relationship with your client off of those platforms. Like that violates their terms and so forth. And so you're really tied into, I mean, you know, there's a financial cost associated with that because they take a cut of every transaction, but you're also tied into their platform in terms of you know, how you do your pricing, what kind of your offerings you're doing. So like some of those platforms, like it wouldn't work very well to do a monthly retainer type thing, for example, like if you wanted to experiment with that with some of your clients. So it's really best for you in the long run to own the relationship with your clients, because relationships are really where the long-term value of your freelance career is going to come from.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's a bit of a tricky balance, isn't it? Because obviously, you know, we said before, don't worry about starting with a website necessarily. You need to go and get the clients, and maybe you have to start on these sites. But ultimately, I think that is a good point. Like you do want to be trying to eventually move people over to purchase from you directly. Like I made the very active decision with my website, like with the coaching and consulting that I do and the products that I sell, it's all through my site. I don't use any third party like marketplaces or services, purely for that reason that you described, which is that when you do list on these sites, you don't own the relationship. I don't even think you get access to their email address. So you're tied into like their messaging system. You obviously have to pay a fee to the service. And yeah, like you said, you just don't own the relationship. So I guess like, yeah, you need to strike that balance between obviously finding your first few clients, which is going to be a challenge, but then eventually trying to make sure that you own the relationship. And actually one idea that kind of occurred to me as you were talking, Ryan, was maybe even using something like Quora or Facebook groups or something, or trying to find some communities. So not even strictly like marketplaces or like advertising service websites, but just going to finding these communities where your clients live online and trying to outreach to them there, where you're not actually connecting with them in a marketplace. Have you had much experience with that kind of thing, or is that a good approach? What do you think?
Yeah, so I think that if you're going to do that, what I would encourage you to do, and this has been beneficial for me, is don't sell yourself, be helpful. So try to, wherever it is that your clients congregate. So if, you know, the more niche you are, the more focused you are on who your clients are, the easier it is going to be to find them online. But there's a billion forums and Facebook groups and, you know, communities online where people congregate on the most niche topics. And so if you can identify who your clients are, and then you find them in those communities, and you become a regular contributor to those communities and are helpful, then it's kind of like a much more natural sales process, basically, over time. It's not like a quick thing, but if you just go to some forum and start spamming like your services, like they're just going to ban you right away. So you're going to make a lot more money ultimately by being helpful and providing value, and just trying to think of it as like, how can I convert people from day one, but how can I be valuable to this community? And then over time, like you can, you know, mention your products and services and those kinds of things. But I do think that that's a valuable contribution. One other point I would make is to make a distinction between owning your clients in terms of your relationship with them and your messaging and so forth, and then the payment model. So like, you don't necessarily need a website in order to get paid from your clients. So you could connect with a client on Facebook or Craigslist, rather, who you own that relationship. You guys are exchanging emails, you call them, you meet with them in person, whatever. Like, you know, you use different communication mediums as it makes sense for you and that client. And they pay you with PayPal, or they send you a check, or they, you know, use Stripe or whatever it is to pay you. I think that's fine. You still don't need necessarily a website in that case. And like I said, I mean, I got away with not having a site for a lot of years. I would just send people examples of my work and case studies and so forth over email, and that seemed to work great. So
yeah, that's a really good idea. I mean, you want to just keep it as simple as you can in the beginning, and don't let yourself get bogged down by the technical things, like payments. If it can be a simple case of, look, here's my PayPal email address, that's probably the simplest thing, isn't it? And or otherwise, yeah, accepting a check or something.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So with the clients, either your clients, or I don't know if you have like a recommended split for this, but I'm wondering as well, with clients you work with, is there any kind of ideal split between new clients that you're bringing in and maybe referrals you're getting from existing clients, or even repeat clients who you're working with again and again? Do you have any kind of recommendations around what kind of makeup of clients and where they're coming from you should be aiming for?
I don't have like kind of a blanket recommendation, partly because I think that depends on, again, like on your situation. So in my case, I have tended to, like I get a decent amount of referral business, and repeat business, but probably not as much repeat business as some other people would, because my niche is startups. So I work a lot with funded startups who are building kind of the first version of their app. And what that means is that a lot of them are gone in a year or two. You know, they cease to exist. And so like, they're not going to be hiring me. Now, the people that I worked with there, they may go on to other projects and it may make sense for us to work together again. But, you know, my clients just have a higher death rate than some other industries, unfortunately. So it's really going to depend on your industry in terms of like what that exact mix looks like. But I also think that you want to be raising your prices over time. That, you know, if you are charging the same that after 5 years as you are whenever you started, like you're doing something really wrong. So there's going to be some drop off in your client base over time, just because of that. It's not going to make sense for some of your clients anymore, and that's okay, as long as you're getting new clients to replace them. And, you know, you do that in a responsible way where you help them make that transition as you raise your prices, and you ideally like introduce them to other freelancers and shops who are more affordable and so forth. But, you know, in my case, I mean, I'll tell you, like, I've been doing this for 9 years. Probably 60% of my work is referral or repeat business, and 40% are new clients. So in a given year, I'll usually take on, I'd say 2 to 4 new clients, something like that.
Sorry, that was over a year, did you say? 2 to 4 new clients?
Yes. Yes. Oh, so wow. Like one every 3 to 6 months, and the rest are either repeat business or referral business or inbound leads from some other source.
Okay. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, I guess that, so obviously, because you're doing quite big like project work, yeah, it works out well because you're not having to spend too much time doing outreach. If really your goal is like, you know, 3 or 4 like new clients per year, as long as they're good quality, you get that buy-in, that commitment, and you have those expectations going forward about what the work's going to involve. Like it's, I guess it's quite nice because, yeah, you're not having to constantly be on the like prospecting outreach treadmill.
Yeah, I try to have like some business development systems that are always running, even whenever I'm busy, just because there's a lead time for those things. And so if you try to spin them up once you need them, that's too late. So I try to keep them always running. But in general, it's better if you can, I mean, I have a project minimum that I've raised consistently every year, like my project minimum goes up. And that helps me to really focus my time on looking for a few bigger projects, which I have found is like a better fit for me than like 1,000 tiny projects.
Yeah. And actually I just want to quickly go back because, when you mentioned raising prices again, the idea that you talked about before, like when you need to be raising your prices gradually over time, what does that communication look like when you're maybe dealing with an existing client you've worked with for a number of months and you're turning around to say, hey, I need to raise my prices because I'm in higher demand, I'm getting busier, and the price is going to be going up. Generally, a client, I imagine, would expect that the price would go down. Like as they're giving you more business, as you're developing a relationship, they kind of get a bit of a special rate from you, rather than the other way, which is going up. What does that communication look like? Or yeah, how do you kind of, when you're saying, hey, I need to increase the price, how do you do that in the best way?
Right. So part of this comes back to not charging hourly. So if you're charging hourly, then you really do have to figure out some way to either, get rid of your client and replace them with somebody who's willing to pay more, or convince them to pay more. If you're doing value-based pricing, where you're giving clients a quote for a project, then there isn't really the same concept of like raising your rates. It just means that the amount that you're willing to do this project for goes up. But right. Unless your projects are all very similar, that doesn't necessarily have to be and shouldn't be a point of conversation for a client, really. It's just, you know, like they get a price for a particular project and it's up to them to decide whether or not that is a good value for them. But it not necessarily like you're not hiding anything, but it does kind of like obscure the kind of this question about like the value of your time, which is good because that's not really the point of what you're selling to clients. Like you're selling expertise and the ability to create value for them. So that if you are doing a more value-based pricing approach, it makes it easier to quote unquote raise your rates in that scenario. If you're going to raise your rates for for existing clients and you're charging hourly, there's kind of a whole method that you can use to do that. It basically starts with you kind of talking to the client, really setting the stage for what the work that you've done with a client, what value it's added to their business, and how you basically asking them like, how can I be more valuable to you in the future, and really listening to what they say, and then putting together a plan for what you're going to do for this client moving forward that ties into whatever it is that they told you. And then also ties into the fact that like you are changing the way that you do business to better be able to do that. And as a result, you're going to be more selective with the clients that you take on. And so you're going to be raising your rates to compensate. But this is kind of a process that you have to do over time. And there's communication involved that really kind of makes it more palatable. And ultimately, like some clients are just not going to go for it. No matter what you do, no matter how you present it, like they're just not going to be happy about that. And that's part of why, you know, a lot of the stuff around pricing is really, it's more emotional than logical. I have worked on many flat rate projects where my effective hourly rate on this project was a number that my client would never have paid if I told them that's what I charge hourly. But they were happy to pay that price for the overall project. And that doesn't make any sense logically. If you were happy to pay that price for the overall project, you shouldn't be necessarily concerned about how much I'm making per hour, because you don't care really about how much I make per hour. But it, again, it's an emotional thing of like, well, no one should charge that much per hour. And it bothers me that there's so much focus on this kind of like selling your time thing. I think it's a throwback to the factory environment from the Industrial Revolution, basically. But ultimately, that's why I don't like to charge hourly. I like to charge a project rate so that clients are forced to only evaluate the price based on the value they're getting from the project. And if that's a fair price for the project, if it takes me 20 minutes or 20 weeks, like it shouldn't necessarily matter to them if that's a fair price to them for the value that they're getting from that project.
Yeah, such a good point. And it comes back to that quote that you said earlier, which is no client wants to buy your time. They, at the end of the day, they don't care how long it, well, within reason, they don't care how long it takes or how long you actually spend at the end of the day. But what's more important to them is the outcome, is that you are delivering something to them that's going to help them make more money and grow their business and whatever else their goals are. And yeah, I really like what you said about that question, how can I be more valuable to you? Because it's basically asking, how can I charge you a higher price? Like, what do you like determine as being valuable? And once you know that, you're like, okay, cool. If you want that, I'm willing to do it for this price. And then if you're able to deliver, like, it's pretty simple. Should be pretty easy for them to work out, like, yeah, I would pay that price for that amount of value. So, yeah, I'm seeing a lot of benefits of charging based on this model.
I also wrote, like, an entire, like, long piece about how to raise your rates with existing clients that kind of goes over that process and that, like, that flow in a little bit more detail. So
yeah, I mean, if you could send that to me once we're done, we'll definitely include it in the show notes for this episode.
Sure.
So head on over to the blog for that. Question around what are the tools, or do you have any recommended tools or apps that you can use as part of your freelancing workflow? Like I'm using Harvest for like managing client time and just keeping track of how much time I've spent with each client, which is going back to the hourly model approach. But I'm using Harvest. I suppose you can do it on a per project basis. You can set budgets in Harvest, and I've got experience with Pipedrive as well, which is really great if you are like during that prospecting phase, like walking people through a bit of a sales pipeline. Do you have any recommended tools or apps that you use in kind of your freelance workflow?
Yeah, so I mean, I use a lot of the same types of things as well. You know, I use Harvest. I'm actually in the process of switching to FreshBooks. And I don't know. I mean, I've tried a lot of like the different proposal tools like BidSketch and Proposify and Nuci. They're all great. I think, you know, it just helps you kind of smooth off some of the rough edges with that. I think a couple that come to mind, one of which I will plug as is my own tool. So full disclosure. One of the things that I did really well whenever I was doing, whenever I didn't have as much inbound lead volume, was Hustle for Leads. And that meant really just building a system to find leads all over the web. So find people who are looking for web development and then mobile development once I switch to that, and be able to filter through those, because, you know, that's thousands of posts all over the web every day, and be able to filter through that and find the ones that actually looked like they were good and not garbage. And I eventually took that system and I built it into a product, and it's called letsmakeapps.io. And so if you're a designer or developer, you can go to letsmakeapps.io, and basically we have humans who every day, we have two people who every day go through, we like monitor hundreds of sites all over the web for web and mobile design and development freelance gigs. And we sort through those and we pick the best 50 to 60 leads, and we send those out in an email to the subscribers. And I have like dozens of freelancers using that who are making five figures a month from work that they've sourced directly from those leads. So that, you know, that system basically grew out of my tool set. And though I, at this point in my career, like, I'm fortunate in that I have a lot of inbound leads, so I don't necessarily have to do quite as much prospecting. That was definitely a really valuable tool that I used whenever I got started, and it still works for people. Another one that's related to that is a tool called Contactually. It's a little bit hard to pronounce, but it's basically contact and then ually.com. So Contactually. And it basically lets you bucket your contacts into different groups and then put a follow-up time period on each of those buckets. So like, I have a past clients bucket that I try to touch base with like every, I don't remember, 3 to 6 months, something like that. And so every day, and then I have like warm leads where these are people that like I'm talking to about work that's going to kick off in the next few months, let's say. And those I want to touch base with like once every other week or whatever it is. And so then every day I get an email from Contactually that's like, hey, here are the people you need to follow up with today. And here's some context about the last time you talked to them, and so forth. So it just helps me like not let people slip through the cracks, because follow-ups are really important and something that most people have trouble with, especially as you start to talk to hundreds of people over the course of your career. It's really easy to kind of let things fall through the cracks. And, you know, you talk to somebody who's like, hey, you know, it turns out we're going to cancel this project, or we're not going to move forward with this project, but follow up with me in 6 months. And this makes it really easy to just put, you're like, ah, no problem. You just pop them into the lost leads bucket, and then you follow up with them in 6 months just to see how they're doing, et cetera. Those kinds of things will make a huge difference to your career in the long run.
Thanks for the recommendation. Yeah, Contactually, that's excuse me, like a really good point. Yeah, you do need to be active at like re-engaging with people, like, because sometimes it's just, you know, not a good time. And if you are active about trying to re-engage when it's hopefully a better time, I think people really appreciate that that outreach. So, yeah, that's a really good idea. Regarding your own personal productivity habits while you're like working on client projects and just how you conduct your own work, do you have any like personal productivity habits or recommendations that you really live by?
Yeah, I mean, I've been like a productivity nerd for a long time. I would say like the things that, you know, I kind of have like a punch list of the things that have been most valuable to me out of like all the things I've ever tried. By far the most valuable thing for me is getting up early. And we could talk about that, because I have like a billion things to say about like about sleep and about getting up early. But for me, the thing that I figured out recently is that the most important thing that I can do for my day is actually the night before to turn off all of my devices at 8 p.m. So I turn off all my devices, my phone, I put my computer away. The only device that I use is my Kindle. No TV, that kind of stuff. Because if I do all that, I'm kind of bored, basically. Like, my wife and I will hang out or whatever, but she goes to bed pretty early. And so I'll usually be in bed by 9 or 9:30. And if I'm in bed at 9, getting up at 4 is easy, or 4:30 or whatever. So I'm up most days before 5. And if you get up that early, it's so easy to get stuff done throughout the day. Like, you can fly through your morning, get a ton of stuff done before anybody even emails you. I mean, I get basically no email until I've been up for 6 hours. And at that point, like, I've already put in a full day's work, essentially. And so that then, which is good, because then my day starts to shift a little bit more towards the kind of handling things that come up and being a little bit more reactive. And I think most people start their day in that phase. And they spend their whole day just reacting and trying to keep their head above water. And they never really get to do the things that require you to take step back and take a deep breath and work in an uninterrupted, focused way for, you know, 2 or 3 hours at a time. And that I have found to be like a huge productivity boost. I'm not a morning person, for the record, at all. So like, I'm a natural night owl. I like to stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning. But I have found that I'm so much like everything about my life basically is better if I get up early, with almost without exception. So I have worked really hard over the last 10 years, essentially, to shift that about my personality. And for me, the key is not to get up early, it's to go to bed early. And the key further is, if you want to go to bed early, for me anyway, is to put away all the stuff that I waste time on at night, not going to bed. And for me, that's my phone and my computer and my iPad and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm so glad you made this recommendation. I'm very similar in terms of, I'll head to sleep about 9:30 and get up very early. And, you know, what you described is a very common problem. People, I feel, get stuck in this, to use your word, reactionary like state, where, you know, they start work, they respond to email, and then all day they're just reacting to other people's needs. And then I get emails from people who are like, oh, I never get to do any like project work, any like deep work, and actually do the things that require my focus and attention. And because they're always having to, like knock these tennis balls back out of their court and react to all this work. And my recommendation, exactly the same as you, Ryan, is just like, get up earlier, or go to sleep earlier and then get up earlier. And having that time alone in the morning is incredibly valuable. And so, I mean, my routine's pretty similar. I get up, I do some work before I leave for my day job. And even at my day job, I'm the first in the office about 6:30 and get some work done before anyone else arrives. It's a really nice, very nice way to start the day. And it's nice because you have more energy, you have more mental bandwidth at the beginning of the day, I find. And so you can get some of those high impact jobs done when you've actually got more energy, rather than, you know, a lot of people I feel react to all these things, and then in the afternoon they're like, okay, I really need to try and do some work now, and they've already spent so much mental bandwidth that it's hard. So I love that recommendation.
So I think that for me, I mean, I do daily habits, and I have like things that I try and knock through every day. I really slimmed down my list of daily habits. I used to have like 10 or 12. I have 5 now, but if I had to, I could slim it down to just this one, because basically turning off my devices at 8 p.m. will change my life, because I'll go to bed early, I'll get up early, and, you know, it's kind of all downhill from there. So.
And in terms of how you structure your day, do you use any kind of any productivity techniques like the Pomodoro technique? Do you batch specific tasks, or how do you kind of structure your day?
Yeah, so I do a lot of this kind of stuff that I'm sure you guys talk about and think about. So I do Pomodoros. I don't do the full Pomodoro technique, but I basically, like, whenever I'm doing focus work, I'm pretty much always have a Pomodoro timer running, and I try to get in basically 8 Pomodoros a day. 25-minute Pomodoros. I've messed around with like lots of different lengths of Pomodoros. I'm currently doing like kind of the classic 25 5-minute break, but I've also found it useful to do 45-minute with a 15-minute break, which is actually something that the military does, like for training. If you're doing like classroom training in the military, which I was in the Navy, they'll often do like 45 minutes of like training time and then a 15-minute break and kind of repeat that. And I've found that to be good if I'm doing work where it takes me a while to kind of get into it, not necessarily from a kind of like psychologically sense, but like even just like programming is like this, where it may take me 15 or 20 minutes to really kind of understand like what it is I'm trying to do, just to kind of get it all loaded into my brain. And I don't want my timer going off 5 minutes after that. So 45 minutes like works a little bit better for some cognitive tasks for me. But so I do the Pomodoro thing. I do... I batch stuff. Like, I really try to chunk things together. I try to only check my email a few times a day. That's really hard, but for the most part, I found that to be beneficial. The other thing I do that I don't know where I found this, and I don't hear a lot of people talking about it, but I found it to be really useful, is I keep a momentum list. So it's kind of like a reverse to-do list, where throughout the day, anytime I do something productive, no matter what it is, no matter how trivial, I put it on this list. And I find that this is really helpful in the afternoon, to look at this list and to be like, I feel like, I don't know, I'm kind of losing steam, not feeling super motivated. Not sure like you just kind of, I forget like all the little things I've gotten accomplished throughout the day. And this is really helpful to me to kind of glance at and be like, oh, like here's the list of what I actually did today. Like whether it was something that was on my list to do or whether it was something that came up that I needed to take care of, you know, that's productive stuff too. Like that should go on your list as well. So that momentum list thing has been helpful for me. Just, and now it's funny, like if I don't have paper or something and I do something productive, if I can't write it down, I feel like it doesn't count. Like I feel like I need like the, you know, it's like the satisfaction of checking something off. It's like a similar type of emotion. So.
Yeah. I love that idea of the momentum list. It's not a to-do list. It's almost like a to-done list.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's really cool. I mean, I think, it triggers those like positive, I think, what is it, like dopamine in the brain or something.
Exactly,
that, like,
yeah.
makes you feel good. And actually, yeah, we use, at work, we use Pipedrive a lot, for managing the clients and following which stage of our kind of sales process they're at. And, yeah, like you have a list of activities each day and every interaction that you make with a client, which you attach to that client, like whether it's a phone call or an email, it all, so you've got this nice history for each client, but it, even if you didn't have an activity initially scheduled, if you complete something for that client, it goes onto that list. And so it's kind of the same thing. At the end of the day, you have a list of all these things that have just been crossed off, all these interactions that you've made. And you have to try not to, like, again, make it, what am I trying to say? Like, it can't be a thing that makes you feel productive when you're not actually being productive. You know, you've got to try and look past it sometimes and obviously assess whether you are actually making the sales at the end of the day and all this sort of thing. But it does keep the momentum going. And I think from that perspective, I really like it for keeping momentum and motivation high. Yeah, so I love that idea.
Yeah, I mean, I call it momentum list just because for me, like the momentum of my day is really important. If I don't have like a good morning, then I'm not going to have a good afternoon. Like it's really hard for me to rescue a bad day. Just because I mean, I'm working on it. That's something that I found really difficult to do. It's much easier for me to kind of keep the momentum, even if I'm doing stuff that like in the morning, it's productive, but it's maybe not like the best use of my time. I've still got momentum and then I can kind of shift like what I'm doing to something that's more effective, you know, kind of in a broader sense in the afternoon if I need to.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really smart. And you're right. Like rescuing a hard day can be tough. I think a lot of people are like, oh, I'm not getting much done. I'm not really getting what, getting the important things done. I'll just give up today. I'll try again tomorrow.
Right. So, exactly.
Yeah. Having that motivation or momentum list is definitely a good way to rectify that. Well, look, Ryan, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been really interesting talking to you. I've definitely like got some really practical tips that I can take away from this. I hope people listening have, I'm sure they will have got a lot of value from listening to your recommendations. Where can people go online to learn more about you and maybe get some help from you if they need it?
Yeah, so I think the best place is just go to ryanwagoner.com. And I, like I said, I write there primarily about freelance and consulting related topics. But there's, if you scroll down to the bottom, there's a section called archives or something. I blogged for many years about more stuff related to productivity and time management and some of those kinds of things. And so you can read some of the old posts that I wrote about that kind of stuff as well.
Well, yeah, again, one more time, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been, awesome talking to you.
Thank you very much. It was great.
My name is Paul Miners, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Productivity Podcast. For me, productivity is a tool for getting more out of life. I believe that if you can be more effective and efficient, not just at work, but in everything that you do, that this, I truly believe, is the pathway to a happier and more fulfilling lifestyle. Join me at paulminers.com and sign up to my free email course, the 7-Day Productivity Plan, to learn more about my approach to productivity and how I balance multiple projects, how I use different apps within my productivity system, and how I get more done with less stress. If you've enjoyed this episode, I'd really appreciate if you could leave me a review. Let me know if you have any questions or what you'd like to learn more about. And who knows, maybe I'll decide to talk about it on the show. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next time on the Productivity Podcast.